This podcast is part of the Headstuff Podcast Network.
Hello, you're very welcome to the Alison Spittle Show with me, Alison Spittle. This week's guest, we've got the wonderful Nadine O'Regan, who is a fantastic journalist and broadcaster. And also, very interesting childhood. When she was a teenager, she spent some time working on a project with Ian Bailey. Now, if you've listened to the podcast West Cork, you'll know that name straight away. Or if you live in Ireland, you'll know that name straight away. Basically, he's a man that is under suspicion of murdering a lady called Sophie Toscan de Plantier. And West Cork, as a podcast, is an amazing podcast. You can get it on Audible. And Nadine was a guest on West Cork and shared her experiences of working with Ian. And we talk about it towards the end, and I found it really, really interesting. So yeah, you should have a listen. We talked about loads of other stuff as well, but yeah, have a listen now. This is the So, Nadine, you are a journalist, and I've seen that you've interviewed some very interesting people. Like, you went with David Gray on his US tour?
Well, I did go on David Gray's US tour. That was around the White Ladder time, so it would have been, God, it was far back. It was sort of 2000, 2001. But I slightly tell a lie when I say I went on tour with David Gray, because what actually happened, Alison,
yeah,
I'm not proud. But it was technically my ex-boyfriend who was given the plum assignment of covering the David Gray on tour in the US gig. And I was like, hold up a minute. I am coming this tour. I was like, you're getting a bedroom. You're getting you'll be on the bus. I was like, I am only little. I can totally do this. At the time, I wasn't what you'd call a fully fledged journalist. I was studying. I was doing the creative writing MPhil in Trinity. And I think I maybe just finished that actually, because it was the early 2000s. So I was still sort of finding my way into freelance journalism, and actually hadn't particularly intended on being a freelance journalist at all. But I just loved music, books, artists. I was totally enthralled to people who just I find very inspiring. So I was like, I'm there. I have to go.
Yeah.
So I hung around. I did all the things, discovered the less glamorous side of being in a band. You know, when you're just seeing people at roadies hanging around venues for hours and sound checks and all that kind of thing. But I have to say, it didn't put me off, because as I suppose a little look into what a life of being a music journalist could be like, it was very, very enticing.
And what was it like for David Gray? Because he was like famous, really famous in Ireland.
Yeah, he was just trying to keep me away from him.
Really?
I think everyone was trying to keep me away from him. I was like, hi. I know. No, it was actually for him, to be honest, and on a more serious note, I'd been a fan of his through the first three albums with The Century Ends. He was one of the first people that I'd ever gone to see play in Connolly's of Leppe. Connolly's of Leppe was the only venue near my hometown of Skibbereen that really would have had the indie artists that I particularly wanted to see. So we'd hitchhiked to see David Gray when I was in my teens. And so for me, he was a very special artist. And when the White Ladder album happened, it took him into a completely different direction. His album, White Ladder, is, I think, still the biggest selling album in Ireland ever.
Wow.
And he's known to everyone, his little bobbly head on stage.
Yeah.
He became so massive. He couldn't walk down the street here. But actually, in his character and in his temperament, David Gray is quite melancholic sometimes. So I've interviewed him numerous times over the years, and it's always a surprise to me to meet him, and I suppose to discover that although the success has had obviously huge material effect on his life, he remains somebody who has dark is the wrong word, but certainly a tendency towards melancholia. And actually, the albums after White Ladder, some of them are very dark indeed. So I think maybe the limelight, while obviously very important to his career, wasn't necessarily his natural kind of home.
Yeah, but does that happen anymore now where journalists go like along tours with people? Is it because of print media? Like, what's it like nowadays?
Okay, so this is the devastating thing about being a music or arts journalist in the year 2018. When I started, record companies would ring up publications and say, you know what, we would like to take this journalist to the States to go on tour with this band, or to go to New York to see a gig, go to Frankfurt, go to Berlin. And there was an awful lot of money in the music industry. Bands are making fortunes. So, of course, they could afford to bring journalists out on these tours and have them see backstage and get them to experience everything and then write massive 3-page articles in their publications. That has all stopped now because money has drained from the industry. Literally what happened was Napster arrived, and suddenly it wasn't just the livelihood of the musicians that was affected, it was everybody around them, the publicists, the journalists, everyone who was interested in the creative arts, they all suffered.
So what is it like nowadays? Like what would be like a good assignment for a freelance journalist with musicians?
I was freelance for 7 years and I've been staff, I'm arts editor and a columnist with the Business Post for the last over 10 years. And the thing is now, most freelance journalists are really struggling just to get by a lot of the time. It's very vocational. And it's funny because people can be really down on journalists sometimes.
Yeah.
And they don't see that an awful lot of the arts journalists out there are doing it for pure love. They're doing it to praise albums, to praise performers. They really aren't making very much money out of it. It's just pure love of the experience. So it's very tough now. Like a plum gig now for a freelance journalist, to be honest, there aren't many going. Like it is maybe getting back to the thing of getting to go see a band in, say, Vicar Street that you really love, or going to go see an artist in Whelan's. I went to see Kurt Vile in Vicar Street a few days ago. People would know him from the War on Drugs. And it always still feels like a privilege to me if I'm offered a ticket like that and I get to go in and see somebody amazing and have 2 hours there, you know. And the same if you go see comedy, you know. Like if you walk in the door and you feel like, okay, you're not the one on stage, but you feel like that you've either written about that person, interviewed that person, you feel like you understand their world a little bit. It's actually a really rewarding place to be, and I don't mean that in a financial sense, I just mean that in in an emotional sense, but for me definitely I always wanted to do a job where the work itself was part of the reward. And by that I mean that the fact that you were writing, the fact that you were surrounded by creative people, itself is something that lightens your own life experience.
Yeah it's I totally see that when I meet journalists. And also if I get a free ticket stuff and I'm like, this is amazing.
But like, what do you think? Like, do you meet journalists and are you like naturally wary?
A little bit. It depends on the context. Like it depends on the type of journalist. If it's an arts journalist, I've no problem. But I remember when I was promoting Nowhere Fast, I would just get calls straight to my mobile from people that were just, they would ask me my age and stuff, or they'd ask me about the TV show and then they'd slip in a question at the end. And I'm like, you just rang for that. Like, just tell me at the start and ask me then.
Yeah.
No need to go through the rigmarole of describing what the TV series is like.
But sometimes actually, like, you know that they were ringing for the question at the end and you'd almost prefer if they do it at the start.
Totally.
Just to get it over with.
Get it over with. I mean, one time I was... So the day the TV show came out, I had no time to spare for anyone. And this person was like texting me all day going, have you got time for a phone call? Just one phone call. And I literally said, I have time when I'm cycling from one place to the other. So I put in my headphones and went through the whole
rigmarole of them going, oh, what's the TV show about and what's it like? And, you know, I'm like, yeah, blah, 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 blah. And then they were like, and this question. And I'm like, ugh. Like, this is what you were annoying me all day to.
And what was the question?
Oh, it was about George Hook, because someone had told people that George Hook was playing a dead body, and he had shouted his mouth off about rape, basically. And, like, I don't share my, like, he wouldn't have been on the show if I knew he felt that way about stuff. And it was kind of really hard after, because it's like, no way am I agreeing with him, or like, I don't understand why you. And also, I didn't want to like outwardly punish him any more than what was happening.
Yeah,
know?
Like, I have to say as well, I think one of the kind of tough things for a lot of young journalists coming up is that they get, if they're lucky, they get put into big publications, and then somebody says, oh, this happened to this presenter. Now can you find a celebrity to give out about it? And then we'll put a big picture of the celebrity and we'll put a picture of the presenter. And it's very artificial, you know. They're just told to ring somebody and create this kind of
this
storm.
Beef, and I don't
so you're on your
it.
Bicycle
yeah.
going, I don't think what he did was as appropriate or correct. But you're not necessarily sitting down in a measured way at a computer to really discuss
no.
it. So it almost feels like, yeah, like you're getting a little bit doorstepped.
It's just very different. And also, like, I've been told just keep silent. You know, just don't say it. Because I would say, obviously, you know, I don't really want to talk about it or whatever. And they'll print that. And I was like, oh, she doesn't want to talk about it?
Yeah.
She doesn't want to talk about that?
Yeah, but see, I've been really lucky. And that's the thing about, like, you know, getting to work for the Sunday Business Post. I've never been put in that kind of position.
Yeah.
But I actually have a lot of sympathy for a lot of the younger journalists coming up who find themselves in that position. Because if it's your job, if you're told to do something, like,
Yeah, and I'll think you're a prick, and you're probably not. Do you know what I mean? But I will, like, remember the name and go, like, so that person that texts me, I saved them under cunt. I said, do not answer phone ever again. And I sent a screenshot of the text they were sending me, but I forgot to blur out what I had called them. So this is like in a businessy type thing. I was like, look, this person is bombarding me all the time for a phone call. And it was just had cunt written at the top of it. And I was like, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have sent that.
Yeah, well,
it's just,
you know,
difficult.
So,
yeah.
You got to do what you got to do.
I know.
You're very sorry.
I am sorry, but, like, I'm not going to. It's, you know, that's part of the job.
Yeah, but, you know, like, the other thing about that, though, is, like, times are changing. Like, I'm saying I'm very lucky, or I have been very lucky, but, you know, getting back to, like, George Hook's comments, right, in relation to sexual assault, to some extent, while I definitely don't want to get into the category of talking about them on this, I do understand that in the 20, well, maybe 15 years I've been in journalism, times have changed so much, and what was seen as acceptable to talk about even 10 years ago is definitely not acceptable now. And the way you proceed as a journalist is totally different now. Like, when I started out, right, I'd be doing these interviews with directors of films, stars from films, novelists, musicians, and the most common place to do an interview would be in their hotel bedroom. So you'd go into somebody's hotel bedroom, and, you know, I started out, like, I was sort of 23, 24, and I'd find myself lying on a bed, like, because sometimes there was nowhere to sit. So I remember when Jonathan Franzen, who wrote The Corrections, came, and he stayed in the Shelburne Hotel, and we wound up in his bedroom for me to do the interview. And so he was lying on the bed, and he started sort of taking the piss. So he was kind of doing, striking all these poses and stuff. And there was absolutely nothing inappropriate about it at all. But at the same time, I was very conscious that I was there on my own on a bed doing this interview. You know what I mean? And I don't think now that the publicist would be fine with it, or that I probably would be a little bit more, can we please find two chairs? But, you know, when you think about it, like, and there's been plenty of times when lots of journalists have gotten themselves into situations that, you know, it's not like they're all saying they're part of the Me Too movement, but certainly you would find yourself in situations where a director might say, would you like to stay a little bit longer? Could I offer you a drink? You know, do you want to come to the premiere tonight? And that's something that, you know, I've never felt that it was ever a problem. Mm-hmm. But people say to me now, that's inappropriate. That should never happen. And I'm like, God, I just didn't even think about it. I just thought that was kind of like somebody cracking on to you.
The way things are done.
Well, like, yeah. Well, do you know? But you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, there's a generational movement into a new kind of post-Me Too world where we all have to look at how we structure everything. Mm. Like, actually, even with podcasts now, like, we're in the Head Stuff podcast studio, which is absolutely deadly.
Yeah.
But a lot of people are doing podcasts from their bedrooms. Do you know what I mean? They are. So they've all got their equipment set up. And like, I was asked to do one podcast recently and the guy was like, come over to my house. And I was like, and I knew it was totally fine, but I was just like, I'd prefer, can we do it somewhere else?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Somewhere more neutral.
Yeah. So like, I think it's, we live in strange times like that. And by the way, I'm just going to plug my own new podcast now. It's called My Roots Are Showing, and I'm doing a lot of work on it, so
where did
you can check it out.
Where did you record that?
So at the moment I'm doing my first live show for it tonight, and that's going to be in the City Assembly Hall in South William Street, and that's part of the Festival of Politics. But over the next few months I'm growing it really slowly and just hoping, like, I actually got I got a podcasting lesson last night from a friend of mine. So
we were going
through all the various bits of how to do a podcast well, because I don't really want to come out with something that I don't believe in. Mm. I want something to be good and to kind of be able to stand over it and say, look, this is what I've created. And I'm like, My Roots Are Showing is an interview podcast where I'll be talking to people about their influences, where they're coming from, and how where they come from inspires the work that they create today. But it's a very broad podcast, and as time goes on, honestly, like, I think the whole world is mutating and changing, and we'll all be listening to not just your podcast, but one of your three or four podcasts. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, have you seen? Maeve Higgins has a podcast about, I think it's about breakups, isn't it? And she's another one about climate change.
Yeah. She's incredible. Yeah. And she's one about immigration.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So like, I don't think it's going to be just, this is the Alison Spittle one. It'll be like, this is Alison Spittle on this, or, you know, this, we're gonna just splinter into loads of different niche areas. I think it's gonna be really exciting.
It'd be like the provisional Alison Spittle show, continuity Alison Spittle show.
What did you call your new show again?
Called Makes a Show of Herself.
That was great. I love
Thank
that.
You.
Yeah, because I know you went on Twitter looking for names, didn't you?
I did. It's very hard to come up with a name before you write the show, because you have to do it before you write the show.
Yeah.
And what people have been asking me is, oh, is the show about making Nowhere Fast? And I suppose the last show I did was kind of about preparing for Nowhere Fast.
Yeah.
So I don't think it is going to be about that, but I'm not sure. I just have to.
Yeah.
I'm writing a play at the moment, and I have to get that done before I do my stand up, because I can't write two things.
But like, you've moved to London, so like, how's it going?
It's going good. I'm really excited by how nice people have been to me. Like, people.
Are you doing all the meetings?
Yeah, I am.
All the meetings.
It's so good. And like, my friend is doing a welcome to Camden dinner party, and I'm really excited about that. And she's like, oh, invite this person and that person. I'm like, you're too good to me.
I didn't realize for ages that when people say they'll meet you for a coffee, that is the interview. Do you know what I mean? Like, that they're kind of, they'd be like, oh, you know, we'll just meet for a coffee. And I was like, oh, okay. But why would you want to have coffee if there's, you know, and then later I'd be like, oh, okay. So now, you know, I presume you're in that situation where like, there's a lot of people that you're just going for coffees with.
Yeah.
But like, do they upgrade it to drinks? Do you get dinner?
I'd love that. I'm kind of taking it very slow with professionally stuff I'm doing. I'm kind of like just getting as many kind of comedy gigs as I can. And I do a lot of bits and bobs for The Guilty Feminist, which I'm eternally thankful for.
Yeah.
Because like Deborah, who does The Guilty Feminist, she not only is incredible for her own career, but she really cares about people that are involved in The Guilty Feminist. So it's like me and Kima, Bob and Bisha Kayali and loads of people that she just takes an interest in and just said, well, if you want to do this, then you should talk to this person.
Yeah, which is cool.
She's just too, yeah, it's really cool. And like, she's so self-assured that that it's really lovely to be around her because you feel more confident in yourself just being around her.
Some people are like that. I was actually thinking on the way in of exactly that topic. And I was like, Mary McCallum, so self-assured. And if you go into a studio with her, she's so warm that you're immediately like, yeah, cool. You know,
it's
an aura.
It is an aura. And it's an aura that makes me feel like nothing will ever go wrong.
I know. And which is dangerous.
I know. But I'm really, really, really happy with, we have a mouse in the house at the moment and we're trying to get rid of it. And
I once had five mice in a row in the bedroom that I was in.
No.
And it got to the point where we were literally going to have to like hang a mouse outside the window by its tail as a signal to the other mice that I was not fucking around. I had enough of this shit.
Like, stay away. Yeah.
But like, it was because the hot press was in my bedroom and clearly that was where
they were coming out of.
But I will say I was dating this guy and we got into that point in our time together that it was time to bring him home.
Yeah.
And I was obviously, you know, trying to be charming and lovely and sexy and all those things. So I was in a house share, so we can go up to the room and I opened the door. And unbelievably, right, even though I'd set traps in the hot press, the mouse had, and I apologize to anyone who finds my stories problematic, but the mouse had managed to avoid the trap, but then he had darted out into the main area of the bedroom and he had seemingly died of natural causes and he was there with his paws face up looking at me and my ex, sorry Sean, and Sean was I mean, what do you do? Like, so he got a dustpan and brush. I was like, it was probably the least sexy mise en scène.
just put like a
and
little
the
sheet
smell.
Over. Yeah. You're just like, let them watch.
And I was like, but he just had like a heart. Like he wasn't even in a trap. He just rolled over and was just looking at me on the floor. But yeah, so after that, I've had enough.
I have a humane mouse traps down because I eat meat. So I was like before, sure, look, if they die, that's natural or whatever.
Yeah.
And I got a real mouse trap. This is years ago. And I heard a snap and then I heard for ages. I was like trying to turn up Jeremy Kyle, you know, like there was a
Yeah, you haven't really lived in Dublin until you've been through the mice, the floorboards. I've a lot of stories from that house. It was an old house. It was much loved. Lived there for 7 years with my four amazing housemates. And I was bitter about moving out, but the ceiling was falling down.
Oh, no. Okay, fair enough.
Hey, I'm Alan McGuire.
I'm Sarah Griffin.
And I'm Anton.
And we are the three hosts of Juvenalia, a podcast where we talk to interesting people about the bits of pop culture that were important to them when they were young.
We've talked to Sarah Quinn about Madonna.
Talked to Auntie Donahue about Star Wars.
And we talked to Sinead Burke about Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs.
And that's just three of the 60 plus episodes we have on the Heads Up Podcast Network. So if you remember things from your childhood and want to talk about them, we're here.
Deep chats with sound people about wonderful things from their childhood.
That's what we do here. So give us a listen. Bye, everybody.
See you now.
Bye.
I got to ask you about interviewing Quentin Tarantino. What was that like?
It was awesome, actually. That was the thing. Like, I think, you know, the privilege, like I was talking about this before, but the privilege of getting to meet some of the people you meet, like there's no money. You know, it'd just be such a delight. But I came in and I'll admit, I'd read this article in Rolling Stone, an interview where the interviewer had speculated, and I think he's right, that Quentin Tarantino has a big mad foot fetish because in every single one of his movies, there's a close-up of a foot.
Yeah, yeah.
So obviously I had to wear sandals.
No.
And I was like, hey, just to see. But then I asked him about the foot fetish and he did get a little bit disconcerted because I think it is actually a genuine thing. It's not like it's just Quentin has this. And obviously he had an extreme fascination with Uma Thurman at one point. So Uma's feet were a big deal for him. But it was amazing, actually, just generally to be in a room with somebody and be able to ask, not that I had a huge amount of time with him, but to ask a few of those kind of questions and just literally see somebody that is such a part of pop culture. Like for me, when I was a kid, like Pulp Fiction, we went to see that in the cinema in Dunmanway. I remember just thinking, like, that guy writes the best dialogue and the soundtracks.
Unbelievable.
Absolutely unbelievable. So to get to sit opposite somebody, I mean, one of the only things that's kind of a problem with that is if you know somebody so well from seeing them on screen, this happens particularly with actors, is that you feel like it's almost like a moving statue when you're in the room with them because you're like, whoa, like they're here. I'm here, they're here, we're together. They've come out of the TV and you can get a little bit phased. Like I got a bit phased with Beck, actually, who I interviewed for Hot Press years ago, just because he was such a tiny, like he was like a tiny idol kind of guy. He was a bit like what I would imagine Prince might have been like, in that he was so, so sort of minute and somehow very beautiful and just... like you could pick him up and put him in your pocket and he very softly spoken and just kind of wonderful to be around, but also weirdly intimidating because he had a lot of charisma, you know, a lot of presence.
Yeah, well, I just think about the whole foot fetish thing. Like I would want Quentin Tarantino to think my feet were attractive, but I wouldn't find them attractive. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's that thing where you want them to...
desire your feet.
I don't think I was getting anywhere with it. My feet aren't that great.
But you don't know what kind of feet they're into. You know what I mean? It could be the gnarliest feet ever and some person will find that attractive.
Well, actually, maybe that's what I should have, like, brandished my corns at him and... I don't have corns. But yeah, I should really have gone for, like, the exact opposite of, like, the... Yeah.
That would be good. I don't... I also kind of, you were a part of a big thing this year, a big podcast event.
Yeah.
West Cork, which you can get on Audible, which is like a crime, one of these types of podcasts where it's like, did they do the crime? Did they not do the crime? We're going to do 12 episodes and you're going to get addicted. And I loved it.
Yeah.
I had a whole little Twitter DM group. Where,
did you?
Yeah, because we didn't want to spoil it for people. And I just lashed through it.
Yeah, no, I thought it was so good and I'm going to pay it the ultimate compliment because I actually forgot that I had done the, like when I was listening to it, like obviously I was like, oh, I'm going to be in it at some point, but I was so absorbed in it that when my own voice emerged, it was almost a shock, you know, I was like, God, jeez. Like,
who's that?
But because their storytelling was so good, like you weren't listening for yourself or you weren't listening to see how you popped up. You were just totally brought into them going back through the decades to investigate this murder. This Sophie Toscan de Plante, everybody knows the story. She's a lady who died in West Cork decades ago and they never found out who the murderer was, but suspicion was cast on one particular man, a guy called Ian Bailey. And the reason the podcast makers, Sam Bungie and Jennifer Ford, asked to interview me is because when I was 16, I co-wrote a screenplay with Ian Bailey. And
you co-wrote with Ian Bailey at 16?
Well, what actually happened was we were part of this video workshop in Skibbereen and the idea was we were going to make this community video and it was going to be, you know, getting you into the process of filmmaking, but not as serious as that. But in the end, actually, we got an Arts Council grant. We got other funding. David Putnam acted as a sponsor. So I came up with a storyline that the director really liked and then I fleshed it out a bit more. And then Ian and another lady stepped in and because I was in school and obviously because they probably didn't want a 16-year-old writing the screenplay anyway, they did the bulk of the screenplay at that point and I contributed bits. But it was such an interesting experience when you're 16 because I was just dying to be creative at that point. And so I would have gone to his house. We would have done sort of script meetings. We would have chatted a lot. And that was through sort of a dark kind of winter nights and everybody just feeling very passionate. And actually the film, now I say film inverted commas, video, got made. I still have the screenplay. At some point I may root it out of the attic and treat everyone on social media to a little live reading. But it was very, very strange for me because I have all these, you know, pictures and memories and everything. And then I was in college and I think it was my mum called. It was around Christmas time, actually, sorry. And I was home and then the news broke of a murder. And then at some point in the months that followed, Ian's name began to be bandied around. And my mother was like, "Isn't that the guy that you did the film with?" And I was like, "Yes." And it was just so strange because what happens at that point is, like yourself, like everyone who has listened to the West Cork podcast, your imagination starts going and you start thinking, well, what could have happened? Could this person be reasonably seen to be in a suspicious place? What's happening with the guards? There were so many questions and everybody in West Cork was asking those questions. And then there were many, many Cork cases, as we've all read over the years. So there were actually so many that when Sam and Jennifer contacted me to say they were doing this podcast, I was almost like, oh, that story has been going for years. You know, what new could be found in it? And I just hadn't understood how they were going to envisage it, that they were going to go back to the start. And they weren't going to start with Ian Bailey is a suspect in this murder.
They introduced them as Ian Bailey, the journalist. And in my head, I was like, oh, no, get out of the car. Oh, God.
I can't possibly comment on
that. I know. And I don't even know if he did it. It's just an implanted thing in my head.
And at the end of the day, you know, it's funny because we all talk about it as really, really great storytelling. And it is great storytelling. But I think maybe what's gotten lost over the decades is that it's a very, very tragic, awful story for the family of Sophie Toscan de Plantier. And it's almost strange for me because people come up to me in pubs, people get in touch with me over Twitter, and they say to me, oh, who do you think did it? Who did it? Did he do it? Who did it? And the thing is, like, I can definitely engage on that level. But at the same time, the only thing that kind of bothers me sometimes is that maybe the real story is getting lost of a woman who lost her life. Do you know what I mean? That it's almost beginning to seem like it's not true crime, that it's just almost like fiction or something, because that's the way that I suppose we start to process stories. I mean, what is it they say about comedy? Comedy is tragedy plus time. And to me, it's begun to feel as though the story has taken over. It's getting into the status almost of myth now. But having said that, Sam and Jennifer are phenomenal podcast makers and they're apparently still working on another, I think there's a kind of a follow-up. Wow. And I did meet them in West Cork a few months back and we went for a drink and I got some fairly strong indications of what they think happened, but I'm not going to tell you.
Okay, not on the mic.
No. I really would get into trouble, but
it's fine.
I feel like Jennifer let something slip that I feel might answer a lot of questions.
I find my enjoyment of, because I listen to My Favorite Murder, which is a very big podcast, and it's basically where they talk about their favorite murders, but they're also two very funny women, and they did Vicar Street, did it two nights in Vicar Street and sold it out straight away because they're massive. One of the times they said, is there a local murder? Is there someone who would like to come up and talk about a local murder that happened to them? So some lady came up and talked about a murder that happened in her village. And then a shout came from the audience and said, that's my cousin. And then she went up and then told the story from her family's perspective.
No way.
Yeah.
That's kind of mad, isn't it?
Well, that's Ireland. And I used to really, really enjoy true crime and murder podcasts, but then I had a relative that died violently, so now, like, just this year, so now I'm like, oof. It's like, it's so, I totally get you when you talk about like Sophie and stuff. And it's just the thing that like really interested me about the whole West Cork thing is the guards.
Oh, the guards. Yeah. The guards who accidentally taped everyone.
Yeah.
At a certain point, they were recording everyone by accident.
Oh my gosh.
The point when they should have done things like take photographs, you know, use dictaphones. Like at the time, right, because I was brought up, my dad was a newspaper editor. He edited the Southern Star newspaper for 50 years before his death in 2009. And so I was brought up in an environment where people's words were important to put on record. I mean, Dad had these little dictaphones, and I did a bit of work for him just as probably like my late teens and in college. And you know, fair enough, it was back in the early 2000s, but we had dictaphones. Guards yeah. could use it wasn't like the technology didn't exist. I had them,
yeah,
so I don't
yeah.
know how they didn't. I mean, didn't they do like sketches of scenes and sketches as opposed to just taking a bloody photograph?
Yeah, it was ridiculous. And it was also sometimes when you listen to it and you just go, what does Ireland sound like to people
in America?
Yeah, or anywhere where you're like, oh, the state pathologist was attending a birthday party and couldn't get down because the roads were bad. You're like, oh my God. And this happened in the 90s.
Yeah. And like yeah. the thing about it, I know that my voice was used on at least one kind of trailer for Audible in the States because my accent isn't as strong, obviously.
Yes.
And I think it was a very difficult decision, actually. So this is the thing about, like, say, do you remember when The Commitments was so successful and there was this story that in order for The Commitments to sell in America or to be put in cinemas, they were going to have to subtitle it. But I think, in fairness to Sam and Jennifer, they were worried about that aspect too, because there were some people with really strong accents, but then they didn't want to come in after the people had spoken on the podcast and then go, if you didn't hear that. And the thing is, I think it was very difficult for them with their English accents to not sound like they were in any way parodying.
Totally.
Or being. And I think they, but some of the situations were just, everyone has to admit it,
yeah.
really comic.
Really like, comic, yeah.
Really bizarre. And I think Sam and Jennifer did a great job. But I think sometimes
didn't they mention as well they had Irish heritage or at some point in the pod? I remember there was some sort of like, I used to visit West Cork a lot.
Yes.
Like, okay, fair enough.
Yeah, you're allowed. You're allowed. Yeah. No, we love Sam and Jennifer for sure. But it was, I think it was very funny for them or very awkward for them to try and pay respect to Irish people while also genuinely giving the comedy of some of those scenes, the surrealism of the Garda situation, and as you were mentioning, yeah. the way people couldn't attend important events because Asher, it was Christmas.
Yeah, 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 yeah. And it was, I'm also very interested in the way that Ian Bailey has been treated, like, because there's a lot of suspicion and...
Well, he's in the market every week in Skibbereen selling his partner's paintings and... selling other bits and bobs, and he has poetry and he's always around. Like I went to...
Yeah, when's the last time you've seen him?
So I went to the West Cork Festival, the Literary Festival, and the organiser of the festivals had saved me. I was hosting events at the festivals, but at the festival, but the organiser had saved me a ticket to go see Sam and Jennifer talk about the West Cork podcast. So I get my ticket and I am proceeding in to the venue, and Ian Bailey is standing at the door to greet every single person of the hundreds of people, just so that they can see him and he can see them. He's at the door, will not move. And then when I sat down, I was seated in one of the top three rows. He was just behind me.
Right.
So Sam and Jennifer were doing this interview with Justine McCarthy from the Sunday Times, and talking about their experiences of making the podcast. And I was sitting next to Sam's father and in front of Ian Bailey.
And
how awkward.
Yeah. And he's aware of how awkward that is. And he just, what's the mindset?
Moth to the flame.
Right.
He loves publicity.
Right.
And irrespective of anything to do with any crime. In my experience of him as a teenager, That was pretty much always the impression he cut. He would come into our meetings often clad in a white suit with like a white trilby.
Yeah.
In Skibbereen at the time, back in the 90s, you've got to remember this was the era of grunge and Britpop. So we were all running around the place in grandfather shirts, Doc Martens and cords. And Ian would come in looking like a man from Havana.
Yeah.
And he was somebody who dressed to be noticed, who existed to be noticed. So there are certain people in life who are not content unless they are seen, spotted and at the centre. And for me, in my impression of him, at least, he was one of those guys.
Wow. I just, it's so hard. It's so hard to, you see some events and it'd be like Ian Bailey talking at this event. And I'm like, what's he going to talk about? Like, what's there to...
But see, at the end of the day, like, without him being charged, he has every right to proceed in whatever way he wants. However, it is strange. Like, we'd all be lying if we didn't say the whole thing is strange. Like, it was strange to walk in. I didn't stop to talk to him because ultimately I was asked for my impressions of him when I was a teenager, and I don't really feel any need to continue that relationship now. But he very much wants to be present.
Did he know who you were?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know. I have no idea. Might have ducked a bit.
Yeah. Yeah. If I met him in the shop, he'd be like, oh, milk. Oh, I'm gonna have a look here. That's so interesting. How has the community reacted to the podcast from your impression?
Well, I think people outside West Cork have been absolutely fascinated and gripped by it. And then people in West Cork have a kind of more, I'm not going to say ambivalent reaction, but you see, they lived through it.
Yeah.
So they have their own opinions that are very, very strong. And in a way, it was almost the equivalent of outsiders explaining their story to them, which I think, to be honest, there's potential for people to bristle at that a little bit, kind of going, well, this is our story, you know? But I think they came round to it the long way around, in a way, at least in the impressions I've gotten from my friends and family. Like, they've all listened to at least parts of it now, and everyone that I know has been very, very impressed by it. But definitely they're kind of going, oh, you know, they could have talked to, or they could have, you know, and they all have their own little bit. And some of them are like, you're on the podcast, you know, like, how do you know those people? And for me, it was because myself and Sam had a mutual friend in common. And I had mentioned to Mark, a friend of mine at one point, the story that I had known Ian at a certain point in the 90s. And Mark had just very casually mentioned it to Sam. So it was pure chance.
Yeah.
But I'd imagine that many people probably think that they can add even more to it. Do you know what I mean? There were voices that weren't heard because people didn't want to get involved. So there's probably even more. And I actually think it'd be really, really interesting to see what Sam and Jennifer do next.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of those people will now be like, hang on, I have a comment to make.
Well, I find it very interesting, the whole idea of memory. And I feel that if I was ever interviewed, if an Ian Bailey situation had happened to me, I'd probably retroactively look at it and go, yeah, he showed signs. Or,
well, you see, but the thing is, you are correct in that, because you see, Ian did leave the video project. He had a massive fight with the director, stormed off the set, decided he wasn't going to have any involvement with anymore, and there was a lot of aggression.
Yeah.
So that didn't make it into the West Cork podcast because it is too fundamentally peripheral to their story. But the truth of it was, I would be lying if I didn't have a memory of him as aggressive. So that's just a fact. And he has said that himself. His partner, as she has acknowledged in the podcast, was subject to violent attacks.
That was one of the saddest bits of it, was the absolute...
Devastating, yeah.
Also, they were so... Because I know people that are violent with each other and that are very blasé about it. Like, that happened. You know, me and this person had a fight. And you think, oh, it's an argument. No, it was a physical fight.
Yeah.
It's
But
very
see,
tough.
That's the thing. Like, I agree with you. When she spoke in the podcast, I thought it was heartrending, and I, you know, felt that they handled their interview with her extremely well, but so much came across, a whole lifetime of experience came across in her few short words that she spoke. And one can never presume to know the intricacies of another couple's relationship, but for me, that was probably the most moving and poignant and worrying aspect of the podcast.
Oh no, for me too. Probably because I knew, you know, because you hear so much about the case, so I knew that they weren't going to come to an absolute conclusion about, you know, what had happened to Sophie.
Yeah.
So that was probably the saddest bit for me, was that bit.
Yeah, because it's living. It's two people right now.
Yeah, yeah. And that's, yeah, yeah. It's very hard. Before we go, I want to ask you something not relating to West Cork.
Go on.
So I read up about you that you were involved in a few Le Galaxy songs.
Oh, yeah. Do you want me to reprise my...
Do.
They'll get into so much trouble. The guys will be like, what the fuck? No, so I did two tracks with them for their little club album. So there's a vocal on the club. It's actually the title track. And it's basically me with a foreign accent, shall we say. And I do something along the lines of, do you know le club... And
that's what you did there. Oh my gosh.
And it's set to a banging beat there, Alison. That's what we've got. And they play it a lot. It's a good track. I did another track with them called Chauffeur of Love, where I do my sexy voice.
Right. Give me a bit of sexy voice.
Too hot. That kind of stuff.
So. Oh Lord, because I've always been interested in, especially because in the late 90s was very big for like talking bits in pop songs.
Oh my god, so, like I'm just dying to do a little bit of what's that one, Serge Gainsbourg?
Oh, like the one that's like Coca-Cola, you know, that.
Oh, there's
of,
that
like,
one as well. Yeah. Or there's Donna Summer, I feel love,
or there's like Britney Spears, Don't Look at Me, or whatever, do you know.
I am ready. Sign me up. Yeah. I love nothing more than going to a studio.
Yeah. Because I, sometimes, especially with some Britney Spears songs, and they're like, Britney, I just need you to go, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. How, as a producer, do you say, Britney, I want you to pretend that you're orgasming more, or, you know?
No, but apparently, like, when Guns N' Roses were making Appetite for Destruction, Axl Rose didn't think the sound was sexy enough, so he decided that he needed to have sex with his lady on the floor of the studio. So at a very low level, there's like a, you know, like,
oh my god, that's a Me Too moment for the engineer. Can I get some more reverb on this?
But it was just to add in that little bit of sex, so you don't actually necessarily recognise it as a sex noise, but it is there buried low in the mix.
Oh my god.
Just saying to you.
You're like, why am I tingling? Nadine, this has been great. Thank you, Sam.
So welcome.
This podcast has had it all. You know, tragic murder, and then like sex at the end. It's all good.
Thank you for having me.
No, thank you. And what's the name of your podcast again?
It's called My Roots Are Showing, and it is now on Spotify, iTunes, Stitcher, and also SoundCloud. And I'm going to be putting up new ones over the course of the next few months. Next week, actually, I think we'll have a new one. So
amazing.
It's going to be with some brilliant artists, Darren McGarvey, Mulatu Okuru, who is a Nigerian author who came out of Direct Provision in Ireland and has written a book about her experiences, and the brilliant Dublin rapper Mango.
Ah, amazing. I'm going to actually listen to that myself. So have a lovely day. That was great. That was good
right?
Fun. Yeah.
You'd be like, listening back going,
Yeah, I know. So you should go check out Nadine's podcast. I always love new podcast people. Also, you should check out Garrod Farrelly's podcast, Fascinated. He's a great comedian, really funny guy, but he's really sincerely into pop music, and he interviews, people like Chesney Hawkes, loads of great pop stars from the 90s, and just people that he's interested in. So it's a really, really, really good podcast, and you should check that out. There's loads of new podcasts on the Head Stuff Network. Taranoia, Tara Flynn's new podcast, Up to 90. Two very funny ladies there, Emma Doran and Julie J. And they talk about all things 90s. So if you're into nostalgia and laughing, you should go check them out. One of my favourite new podcasts, though, is called a podcast called Phone and Get In. And it's presented by a guy called Dave Coffey. And I've done an episode for him before, and I'd love to do more. And it's just Ireland's best improvisers and comedians phoning in, pretending to be people phoning in a pretend complaint phone show. And it's really great fun. I am going on tour at the start of next year, and I really want you to come along. So I'm going to give you dates of my tour. First off, I am doing my old show, Warrior Princess, in December in London. I'm very excited. The first show was nearly sold out, so I had to put on a second show on at 7:30 on that same day. So on Tuesday the 11th of December, I'm doing a show at 7:30 and a show at 9:00 in a place called 2 North Down near King's Cross. I have a special code called BROFF, and you can get tickets to the 7:30 show for a fiver. If you type in B-R-O-T-H, that's BROFF, B-R-O-T-H, when you're ordering tickets online. I'd love to see you there. I think it's going to be the last ever outing of Warrior Princess, although I do want to film it just to have it there, but I'd love to see you there. But now about my tour, I'm going to tell you, it starts off in Carlow, in the Visual Carlow, on the 25th of January. Then it goes to Dundalk. Then it goes to, that's on the 1st of February. On the 2nd of February, Rathove. On the 8th of February, I'm in Central Arts in Waterford. On the 9th of February, I'm in the Whale Theatre. I love that theatre. You should really get tickets there. It'd be amazing. Then I am going to be in Blanchardstown in Drayocht on the 15th of February. Really, really excited about that. It's going to be a good crack. Then I'm going to be in Limerick on the 22nd of February. And then the 23rd of February, I'm going to be in Mullingar. So I'm super, super excited about that. Then I'm going to be in Portlaoise on the 15th of March. On the 21st of March, I'm going to be in Debarra's in Clonakilty. And then the 22nd of March, I'm going to be in Cork in Coughlin's Bar. And then on the Friday, 29th of March, I'm going to be at Glasgow Comedy Festival doing a new show and of this tour as well. And then on the 30th of March, I'm going to be in Vicar Street. I'm super, super, super excited about that. And then on April 1st, it's Conor O'Toole's birthday, who is a great lad. And I think he is the bee's knees, so I do. Thank you very much to Sarah Garvey, who's the producer of the Alison Spittle Show. Thank you very much to Bobby Ahern, who made the music. Thank you very much to William Conway, who did the artwork. Thank you very much to Alan and Paddy from the Head Stuff Network, who let me come in and use the studio, and they've been very, very good to me. And thank you so much to you for listening to this. I'm sorry that I know some weeks I've been late with the interviews and stuff, but I really appreciate you sticking with me. I'm just moving countries at the moment, and when I start my life out, the podcast will be a bit more regular. But thank you so much for being there and staying with me, and we'll have a good year next year. It'll be good crack, and getting lots of my London friends to come and be on the podcast, so there'll be a lot more people that live in London on the podcast, because that's where I live now. Guys, it's been a pleasure. I'll chat to you soon.
This podcast is part of the Head Stuff Podcast Network.